The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, Kesha, piracy, attitude is everything, and Eurovision. It's the CMU podcast, a weekly roundup of all that's important in the music business. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is CMU's business editor, Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
All that is important in the music business this week. That's setting us up to fail, I think.
No.
You think the four things we've chosen to talk about is everything of importance in the music business this week. Nothing else of significance happened.
If it's not in, it's not... Hang on, I needed longer to think up a tagline. If it's not in, it's not important enough. It doesn't really roll off the tongue, does it? I'll have something better for next week.
I know for a fact that something important happened relating to the making available right in America this week, where there isn't a making available right, and they were talking about whether there should be, and I think they decided they shouldn't. But I've not read up the paper yet that summarises what happened, so I don't know what happened, so I haven't written about it yet, so I can't talk about it yet. It's probably not interesting, but I think it is important, and it is not in this week's podcast. So therefore, this podcast is not a weekly roundup of, well, all that is important to music business. It's most of what's important
that
to music
is now
business.
Not only in the podcast, but it is placing an incredibly boring thing that no one cares about right up front. Everyone's now switched off.
But if you haven't switched off, you can read all about that in the CMU Daily, because I'm planning on writing about it once this podcast is finished for the Friday edition. So if you tune in to the Friday edition, do you tune in to the CMU Daily?
Yeah.
If you tune in to the Friday edition of the CMU Daily, you'll be able to read all about what's happened with the making available right where there isn't one in America, and there still isn't one, even though they said that perhaps there should be one. So we have now covered that. So therefore, this is all that is important that happened in the music business this week. I like the slogan. Well done.
Do you know what else happened this week?
Coming up with that slogan. What else happened this week?
The Brit Awards!
It's true, it was.
Which we're not going to talk about as a discussion, because... why would we? But that happened.
It did.
I went to it.
You did. I didn't go to it, nor did I watch it, on account of me not owning a television. And that's where it was. It was on TV. Actually, presumably, was it live streaming?
Yeah.
Who had the live stream? Was it Google or Yahoo? Or
it was on the internet.
It was on the internet. So actually, that's not a good excuse that I don't have a television. But I don't have a television, so therefore I didn't watch it. I don't really know what happens, even though if you go to the website, you'll find that there's a report of the Brit Awards written by me. But I base that on a couple of tweets I read this morning. Adele won some awards. That's pretty much all you need to know.
That is basically all that happened.
And Justin Bieber tried to burn down the O2. Was that something?
There was an extraordinary amount of fire involved in the show. Not just Justin Bieber. A lot of fire in Justin Bieber's performance, but there was a lot of fire elsewhere.
You sure it wasn't that during Justin Bieber's performance, the venue caught fire, and that's why there was a lot of fire in all subsequent performances?
There was a joke involving a fire alarm and a flamethrower.
Was there?
Yeah, so you missed that.
An Ant and Dec joke.
An
Ant and Dec joke.
But it was Ant, I think it was Ant, it was one of them, firing a flamethrower in the air a la Kanye West last year. And those things fire quite a lot of flames quite high in the air. It was a bit of a surprise. And then they pretended the fire alarm had gone off.
Comedy gold.
Comedy gold it was.
It's like SMTV Live all over again.
But the other thing that happens, it seems, when even in an arena... if you set off a lot of fire, it gets really, really hot.
Actually, because last time I went to the Brit Awards, I think was 2 years ago. I can't quite remember. And there was a lot of fire. I think it was Take That, actually. Somebody had a lot of fire.
Mark Owen caught fire, yeah.
And I do remember, even though I was a very long way away from the stage, you're right, the whole place does warm up quite quickly. Who knew fire was hot? So that's what we sent Andy to the Brit Awards this year.
That's a big takeaway.
And he came back with the headline news that fire is hot.
Yeah.
So well done. I'm glad we invested some time into sending you to Greenwich to see the Brit Awards in the O2. It's CMU house policy not to give when brands take naming rights, as they call it. So O2 would tell you it's the O2 Academy Brixton. But there are...
even though it's definitely not.
There are only 7 people in the world who call it the O2 Academy Brixton, and they either work in O2's marketing department or in the bit of the Academy Music Group that does the sponsorship deal. So we call it the Brixton Academy because
that's its name.
That's what it's called. But the O2 is the O2, really, isn't it? Unless, I mean...
you can't call it the...
can you still... you can't call it the... can we still call it the Millennium Dome? Do people even remember what that is? I know it annoys AEG when you call it the O2 Dome or the Dome. So, because we used to do that because we knew it to join. But I think these days we are actually quite on brand when it comes to the O2. But anyway, the MasterCard Brit Awards were this week and it was hot. So there you go. That's all we have to say about that thing that happened in the music
business.
Those
are the important bits of that thing. Yeah, so that's what I've done this week, important research. What have you been up to?
Well, we had some CMU stuff happening this week. You'll remember on last week's podcast, we were talking about CMU Insights at Output.
Vaguely remember.
Is a music business conference in Belfast, a really big music business conference. There was a lot of people there. And quite a few of them came to our talk on dissecting digital dollar, so that was good. So it went well, I think. We were discussing on last week's podcast whether or not they'd have me back next year. I mean, they've not called yet. I don't know whether that's a bad sign.
They might not be planning next year's just yet.
It seemed to go very well. We had a CMU DIY event down at the Red Bull Studios, which technically was before the last podcast, as was CMU Insights Output, but it all happened after we recorded last week's podcast,
yes,
if that makes sense. And that also went very well. So I still need to upload my slides to cmudiy.com for people who came. But so there's been lots of CMU stuff happening this week, which is much more important, I think we can all agree, than the MasterCard Brit Awards at the O2 in Greenwich. Anyway, let's get on with this podcast.
Yes. Well, there has been one story that has dominated, well, not even just the music news, just kind of entertainment news in general this week, and that is a ruling in the ongoing legal battle between Kesha and Dr. Luke.
And it's interesting because this is a story we've been reporting on for quite some time now.
Well, 2 years, yeah.
The litigation at the heart of this story began some time ago, and there have been a number of developments and rulings and judgments as it has gone through the motions. But it is interesting that this was the moment when it became a really big news story worldwide. And lots of, well, Kesha's fan base had already been increasingly vocal on this, and we've been reporting on the petition and the protests that they had been organising. But the artist community really started speaking out on this week, and I think that's perhaps what took it. I mean, Taylor Swift spoke out, obviously the Brit Awards, Adele spoke out. Big name artists now have been commenting on this story, in the main siding with Kesha, and that has made what has been a long-running story. And actually, I mean, you were looking, the actual court date for this main part of this litigation is like a year away.
It's more than a year away.
So we're still...
I mean, the deadline for submitting all documents, etc., and being ready for trial is it's about now next year. It's mid-February 2017.
So we're not looking... We're talking...
So you're not going to see a trial date before the summer next year.
So we're very much still in the middle of this legal battle, although there was a significant ruling this week, hence the coverage, hence the much wider comment on it. It's a very difficult story for us to discuss on the podcast, not least because the core case is yet to go to court, and so even the court hasn't discussed the core allegations at the heart of this case, because that's not what last week's ruling was about. It was about a specific application on the part of Kesha's lawyers. But lots of the information hasn't even gone into court yet. So actually, it's quite hard for us to comment on big chunks of this story. But we felt we had to talk about it because it has been such big news. Why don't you start by just giving us the bullet points of the background of what the dispute between Kesha and the producer Dr. Luke is about?
Well, this started in 2014 when Kesha sued Dr. Luke, her producer and label boss.
And sort of mentor for a big chunk of her early career. So working on music together, and then he was releasing it through his label. But she also had associations with his other companies as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, she accused him of various things, but the most serious allegations are that he drugged and raped her, which obviously is an incredibly serious accusation. He countersued with a defamation lawsuit, saying that these accusations were invented because contract renegotiations weren't going her way.
Yes, so he throughout has denied the allegations of assault and the other allegations Kesha has made, and is saying that this is simply part of a general fallout between him and Kesha, and the allegations have been made up. And he sued both Kesha and her mother for defamation because her mother also went on record as backing up what her daughter had said. And what happened last Friday is, as we said, this case has been rumbling on for some time. There were some developments of the defamation case a while ago.
Last month, I think, or possibly earlier this month, some bits of Dr. Luke's defamation case were dismissed.
Yes, although only in one state, not another.
Yeah, so there's still, I think it's Tennessee.
Correct.
In New York it's gone, but in Tennessee still running.
So basically, anything involving Kesha herself has to happen in New York State. We're in complications of American law and state law here. Has to happen in New York State because the contract between Kesha and Dr. Luke was signed in New York, and the jurisdiction that governs that contract, according to the contract, is New York State. Whereas with Kesha's mother, she's not party to that contract. So Kesha's mother, therefore, can have her legal battles in any state that she wishes. And so that was the point, that the New York State bit was abandoned, but that part of the case continues elsewhere in America. There was also litigation with Kesha's manager.
Yes.
Which, again, that was dismissed. I can't even quite remember. There are so many elements to this legal battle. It is quite hard to keep up with the various different elements that have been happening. But I suppose last week's was relatively straightforward in that Kesha and her lawyer came to court and said, this legal battle has basically resulted in Kesha's career completely going on hold because she can't release recordings for anybody else because that's what a record contract says. When you sign a classic deal, certainly for a major record company, there's an exclusivity element to the deal. You can only make recordings for your record company, your record label. You can't go off and make recordings elsewhere. So Kesha can't put out any more records. It's quite a while now since her...
Well, yeah, her last album, Warrior, came out in 2012. It would, at this stage, be unlikely that she'd release another album till 2018.
Yes.
So that is a long gap.
And what Kesha and her legal representatives were saying is that that's in pop music, that's a sufficiently long gap to basically kill the career. You know, you can't come back after 6 years. And so what they were saying is because this whole thing is still working its way through the motions and it could be another year, 18 months until we even get to court to actually hammer out the court arguments, the court should pass an injunction that says that in the interim, Kesha can go and do another record with another producer and another record company, put that out, her career can continue, and then we'll regroup in 18 months time and we'll hammer out the actual arguments and allegations at the core of the case, which may or may then have an impact on what Kesha can do long term. So that is what Kesha and her lawyer were asking for. That's what went before the New York State Court last week. Kesha was there in person and the injunction was denied. And the judge said that she couldn't give that injunction because she felt it would set a dangerous precedent because the contract between Kesha and Dr. Luke's label, and that's part of Sony Music, was a classic US record industry contract, and that if they were to meddle with that contract here, it would set a dangerous precedent on all the record industry contracts that are under the New York court jurisdiction. So she didn't get the injunction. So basically, in this scenario, I mean, in terms of the previous rulings and judgments, there's been a bit of win and lose on both sides, but that ruling very much went in Dr. Luke and Sony's favour over Kesha.
It did, except in PR terms, where it's gone completely the other way, because as we said before, this has really brought this case to a much wider attention, and a lot of people have spoken out in favour of Kesha. There's been a big swell of... Well, this, as we said, this protest was already going on to try to get Sony to release Kesha from her contract. And now there are far more people calling for that to happen.
Including a lot of celebrities.
Including a lot of celebrities, which obviously then that brings more and more people into the campaign. I mean, the problem is it's not as simple as all that. Everyone's like, why doesn't Sony just release Kesha from her contract? Because partly because Kesha's contract is not with Sony directly. She's signed to several of Dr. Luke's companies. So what happened in the injunction? Part of the reason the judge said that she couldn't grant the injunction, aside from the contract law element of it, was that Dr. Luke had said he would be happy for Kesha to work with another producer while this case was going on. Sony suggested that she could record for another label within the Sony empire. And the judge said, that all seems fine. Although there are certain stipulations within that. Dr. Luke still has to approve the producer, possibly even choose the producer she works with, and would possibly choose one of his protégés, of which there are several. And if she records within Sony, Dr. Luke will still be able to profit from her work, and she doesn't want that because she's saying that he's her abuser.
Yes, and that, again, that comes back to the slightly complicated structure of the deals between Sony and Dr. Luke's label and Dr. Luke's other companies as well. Sony owns the Dr. Luke label, but Dr. Luke has other companies, and there are various different deals between the different companies. So even if they let her work with a different producer and then released it through Columbia, say, or somewhere else, there would still be various licensing deals going on that would come back to Dr. Luke's label that would then be making payments to Dr. Luke.
Yes.
I suppose the key thing to stress is this is not a criminal case. Okay, this is not a criminal prosecution against Dr. Luke with the allegations that have been made against him. And so it's really hard to comment on any of that. clearly, if there had been a criminal prosecution, then you like to think it would be quite straightforward at that point. But because the actual allegations that have been made are yet to be ascertained in a civil court here, let alone in a criminal court, that layers all the complications on, because it makes total sense that Kesha wouldn't want to work with Dr. Luke, wouldn't want Dr. Luke profiting from her music. Because you like to think that if there had been resolution in court with regards the allegations that have been made against Dr. Luke, then at that point there would be no debate. Clearly the contract
It would be made. A fairly simple thing to go, Kesha would like to be released from her 8-album contract with this man who has been convicted of this crime.
And
that hasn't happened.
Don't know the specifics of New York law, but you like to think in that scenario it would be really clear-cut. But it's not clear-cut, and it creates all sorts of challenges for every party, and Sony Music has come under huge pressure. And as you say, it's interesting that the legal judgment very much went in Sony and Dr. Luke's favour last week, but in PR terms, very much the sympathies are, for understandable reasons, with Kesha, which puts Sony in a really difficult position. And you sense that the legal representatives for the Dr. Luke Sony side, through some of the things that they've said, I think perhaps I've inferred this to an extent, they may not have explicitly said it, but the lawyers working for Sony and Dr. Luke and Dr. Luke himself have made no secret of their disrespect for Kesha's lawyer. Mark Gragos, who is, well, he certainly appeared in the pages of the CMU Daily before because he was involved.
He's something of a celebrity lawyer.
And he worked at one point on the Michael Jackson abuse allegations for Jackson. So we've had him within our remit before. And he
also represented Chris Brown in his assault case.
So yes, he pops up under the music news banner quite regularly. He is quite an outspoken lawyer. And as I say, you sense that the legal representatives for Dr. Luke and Sony sort of think that he almost engineered this publicity storm around this one element of the case in order to try and put pressure on Sony and Dr. Luke, but particularly Sony, to ultimately release Kesha from her commitments, even if legally, in the eyes of the court, they're not obliged to do so. Having said that, to date, they haven't really commented much on what their intent is or what their response is going to be to the publicity storm, except they have, well, Dr. Luke in particular, was critical of the lawyer.
So, yeah, still very much an ongoing story, but there may be some room for manoeuvre in this. I mean, there's been suggestions in various articles this week about the bad publicity forcing a settlement in the case, which is one possibility. The other is Kesha has said in principle she's not against recording for another Sony label, but of her fears about the current offer on the table need to be overcome. I mean, one of the things that her lawyer brought up was that, you know, there's every chance if she recorded for another Sony label, they just wouldn't promote the record, because he was arguing that Sony are seeming to side with Dr. Luke at the moment.
And it's not unheard of for artists in major record companies where they lose their internal champion within the major record company, and then they still get sent into studio and record, but because there isn't an internal champion who is making sure that they get all the promo and the marketing that they need, that the record comes out, or sometimes it's even come out, or if it does come out, it comes out and is badly marketed. That's not unheard of in a big record company. So I suppose what they would need to do is to show that there were internal champions, other people within Sony who would love to work with Kesha and could really do that well. There is then the issue, though, of what is Dr. Luke's relationship with that in terms of a veto, in terms of revenue share. And as it currently stands, as we understand it, with the contract between Sony and Dr. Luke, that would require Dr. Luke to concede a little. So we do not know what will happen. And unless an overall settlement comes out of all of this, now that it is such a big news story, this is something that could rumble on for another couple of years, as you say. And it would be a real shame if there is not a way for Kesha to, at least until this comes to court properly in 2017, to put it on a side and go and make some music, which at the end of the day is what she what she does and what she likes doing. So one would hope that even if we are pushing off the full hearing and the full dispute until it eventually comes to court, that there is some room for compromise. But we will see.
US research firm Music Watch has put out some results of some research it did last year that says that P2P file sharing is falling. It's almost halved in the last decade. So hooray!
Good news. Well done, record industry, for defeating piracy there.
Except no.
Oh.
Because there's now a lot more people doing that piracy thing, just in different ways. So
it's good the pirates are innovating.
Yeah.
We love a bit of innovation.
They reckon that in 2004, there were 41 million file sharers. in the US?
To a P2P file sharing. So back then, 2004, that was presumably still Kazaa era.
Yeah.
Maybe nearly LimeWire era.
The bad old days.
And then the BitTorrents were to follow and the Pirate Bays and all of that. But this is American research, so these stats relate to America. So.
There's now 57 million pirates, or bad choirers, as they termed them.
They did.
Bad choirers. What? That's not a word. Bad choiring they used as a word as well.
So, yes, some interesting terminology there. So the point is, and these stats came from a blog post that this company, Music Watch, posted this week, which was sort of responding. They cleverly used a hook, because there was a lot of talk last week about how when Kanye put his new album exclusively on Tidal, and then, do you remember, there was that confusion that initially there was going to be a download and then there wasn't a download. And then people pointed out that although he kept saying on Twitter, there have been so many tweets coming out from Kanye the last week, it'd be hard to find the tweet. But I'm already putting it out on Tidal. You'll have to sign up to Tidal. And then, of course, everyone said, well, you're saying that, but look, it's on the file sharing networks. And some of the reporting about just how much Kanye's new album was out there on the file sharing networks sort of implied that piracy was not as big a deal anymore. And sort of, you remember how piracy used to be something we all talked about and file sharing was something that would be in the news every so often 8 years ago. Well, it hasn't come up so much anymore. But look, Kanye is being file shared and that's a story. And what these guys were saying is, well, actually, really, that's not a story. Piracy continues every day of the week. And while it may be true that P2P file sharing is down, certainly in the US, there are many other ways that you can access music without license and infringe copyright in this here modern age. And the two that they particularly focused on, I say the two they focused on, it's possible these were the two I focused on. It's possible that their blog post had more. But the two I focused on, which they did focus on, was the pulling of content out of people's digital lockers and then what they called stream ripping.
Yes.
But because they decided that bad choiring was a term, I decided that stripping, that's what we should call it when people rip a stream and turn it into an MP3. I'm going to call that stripping.
Yes.
Because I think that's a better term.
But they did say there was a reason why that has become a thing, and it's not necessarily that people realise that they are doing something illegal. The problem of stream ripping apps, it's come up before. I did some research on it, but I'm not sure it ever actually came to anything.
It's true. It's one of the sort of piracy gripes that, I mean, the music industry at any one time has a list of piracy gripes and things move around on the list. Safe Harbors is always at the top of the list at the moment. And I think this piracy gripe has always been at like number three or four on the list, but has never got higher up.
Well, it might. It's possibly even lower than that. It's just it's an underlying gripe.
Because nobody but me looks at the piracy gripe list, unless it gets to the top of the list, nobody else notices. So, yes, this, I mean, none of this is new. I mean, the sharing of links so you can go nab content out of digital lockers, that ain't new. That's why we had litigation against, like, RapidShare. Obviously, the Maker Upload case, that's basically what that is about. And this grabbing streams and turning them into MP3s, that ain't new. And I think a lot of people do it from YouTube, don't they? You can get a little app, you install it on your browser, you press a button, the YouTube thing plays, it grabs the audio and pops it out as an MP3 at the end of it. But increasingly people are doing it on their mobile. And yes, the point that we're making here is that the apps that you need in order to do this are sitting there in the Apple and Google app stores. And people, it was an incredibly high number. Was it like...
It was 73% of the respondents said that they'd assumed that any app providing free music that comes in an official app store must be a legitimate app, because otherwise why would it be there in an official app store?
Now, when people do surveys, I mean, they spoke to 1,000 respondents, people as part of this survey, and then they multiplied it up to get those wider percentages. Whenever there has been piracy research and a portion of the people who are asked, why are you file sharing? Why are you getting music from illegal sources? Whenever those people say, oh, I thought it was legal, part of me is like, oh, did you really? Did you really think it was legal? But having said that, I suppose you could potentially understand this position, which is A, well, we know that when you put apps into the Google App Store and the Apple App Store, there is a little bit of an approval process. A big chunk of that is automated, but it has to go through Apple or Google to appear in those app stores. So therefore, it's sort of reasonable to assume, well, surely they're checking whether or not there's anything illegal happening within this app. And then over here, there is the point that if you download the Spotify app or the Deezer app or the YouTube app, there is free music.
Yes.
So, and that is entirely legal and legitimate. So it's not unprecedented to download apps through those app stores, get a load of free music, and that to be fine.
Yes, because basically what these apps generally do is you search free music on the App Store, whichever one, and you'll find a load of apps that offer free music, and you download them, and a large portion of them don't really work. But the ones that do work, basically, you search for a track online, you find the YouTube video or whatever, some version of it streaming online, and then the app will basically rip it out to an MP3 for you as you listen to it. And so that's what a lot of people are doing. That's partly behind the growth in piracy. But then people don't necessarily realise that what they're doing is wrong, even though clearly that's... How could you think anything
else? Well, it comes back to this, how genuine are people say, oh, well, I thought it was legal. But I suppose it therefore says, well, should the record industry and the publishers be prioritising? Because this has been on their radar, it has been on their agenda, and they have put pressure on Apple and Google to do something about their stores. They've also put pressure on YouTube to try and do something at the back end that means when these apps are going in to grab the audio, the YouTube system tries to stop that process from happening. And there was a little bit of legal action a few years ago where YouTube were going after one of the companies that created one of these apps. So there has been a little bit of talk about this and a little bit of pressure. But when you look at the App Store and you see how many of these apps are still there, you have to think that nobody is really trying very hard when it comes to this. And perhaps what this research shows is, yes, you might be winning the battle on P2P file sharing, whether that's education, whether that's because free streaming services like Spotify and YouTube are just so much more pleasurable than trying to get a BitTorrent. Although we talked the other week, didn't we, how BitTorrent file sharing is becoming more pleasurable because you're getting apps that basically turn that into a streaming experience rather than a download experience. But conventional P2P file sharing is down for whatever reason, but let's not forget there are other forms of piracy on the up. And I think the stripping or stream ripping, whatever we're calling it, is one that is very much on the up. And is there anything that the labels and the publishers and the tech giants can do about it? And should this be higher up the agenda?
Well, should it or not? I mean, another thing that came out of this research was that people who did this were far more likely to buy music and engage with legitimate streaming services. So it's not all gloom, but it kind of adds to that weird grey area that things have always existed in.
But there's so much piracy research, isn't there? Yes, where the, again, that's another line that people give when they're asked to justify their file sharing. And I suppose what these guys were saying is, perhaps 10 years ago, there were no free music services. Now there are, so it's even harder to justify your file sharing, because not only are you nicking music, but you're ignoring the fact that there are free music services.
Well, part of it was that people were using legitimate services like Spotify, but say if they were on the free service, you don't get to download music to your phone. So they were downloading the stuff they really wanted for when they go out of range, you know, when they go on the tube and they can't get an internet connection, and therefore they still had the music that they really liked on their phone, but they didn't want to pay £10 a month to get that function.
Or potentially they didn't know that that's what you got by paying the
£10
a month. Who knows? But as I say, all piracy research over the years, there are some classic excuses that come forward from the people who nick music, and the, oh, I try before I buy excuse. I am a consumer of music, but I use the piracy networks to preview is a line that has been wheeled out ever since the early days. Well, Napster, before Grexter, Kazaa and LimeWire. So quite a few of these excuses were the classic excuses, although it was interesting that overall piracy does seem to still be on the up, and actually the stream ripping thing and the distribution of the apps that enable with that perhaps should be higher up the piracy agenda, the gripe list of the record companies and the music publishers, than it currently is. Time for some CMU approveds now. Andy Malt is going to tell you what music and artists he has been approving this week for to choose from, kicking off with Orca.
Orca, who are back with a new album this year. It's coming out in May. It's called Vath, I think that is how you say that. They're Faroese, so there is a letter in there that does not exist.
You went to the Faroe Islands once, didn't you?
I did, it was very good.
A little festival. Did these guys play?
I saw them play in the living room of the smallest house I have ever been in. it was very good. They play on, their sort of hook is that they built a load of their own instruments out of agricultural equipment. And so that's their thing. Although they're now moving to more sample-based, well, still sampling these instruments, but kind of this new stuff is more kind of techno-y, dance music orientated. I mean, they've always been electronic, but this is more so. They've just released a live video for a track called Grind, which will be on this new album.
So go check that out. Number two, Hannah.
Clay is the song. She is a Grimes collaborator. She is a member of Grimes' live band, which has helped her. Grimes let her perform this song while she was supporting Lana Del Rey on her US tour.
Yes, yeah, so anyone who saw the Grimes set on the Lana Del Rey tour will have seen Grimes and Hannah performing this track together.
Well, just Hannah on her
just
own.
Just Hannah on
Grimes
her own.
Grimes went, I'm getting off the stage, listen to this girl here. And she performed the song. And then they made a video out of that, which that helped last year. And then now it's being properly released. It's got a proper new video. And all well worth checking out. She was a jobbing musician for many years. I think she basically toured constantly for about 6 years. And then suddenly realised that she didn't actually like any of the music she was making, but she'd never really had time to stop and think about that. So she's doing something more to her tastes and more to my tastes. So that's the perfect combination.
Everyone's a winner.
Yeah.
Gold Panda.
Gold Panda is back with a new album, also out in May, like Orcas. And that is based on, I think it started life as it was going to be a sort of audio and photo documentary of a trip to Japan.
So the original intent was to go to Japan, record a load of stuff, and then make music out of it.
Or just, I think, just use the field recording stuff. Yeah, but then it sort of turned into a bigger album project when a taxi driver said something to him in English, which sounded slightly odd and sparked off an idea. And as a result, an album was born.
So inspired by the trip rather than recordings from the trip.
Yes, and then this track, Time Eater, is released this week.
It occurs to me that... I suppose the other Faroe Islands, Nordic, would they be this week's Nordic? Do we count them as a Nordic? But they're sort of up. I mean, they're sort of...
Well, it would depend who you asked. They're owned by Denmark, aren't they?
So that would count as Nordic. So perhaps we do have a Nordic one this week. I was going to say, it's quite unusual for us not to have either a Nordic or a Japanese artist in your approveds. But although Gold Panda was inspired by Japan, he's not a Japanese artist.
No.
Anyway, White Lung is the final approved.
White Lung, who have been a band I have liked for many a year, and they've got a new album coming out in May, like all of these.
Above average, I think you described them. A little slightly low-key approved for this one.
They have always been an above average band, and that is a good thing. And they've got this new album called Paradise coming out in May, and they've released a single called Hungry, and that single is very good. It's a little, maybe it's less raw perhaps than some of their older work. But they've always had a very strong melodic element to their sound nonetheless, and then that's, I guess that's more coming to the fore now. And it's very good.
And it was interesting, you included some quotes from the front woman, am I right in saying that? Talking about how if you come from a sort of a punk background, but then you put a lot of effort in your songwriting, sometimes the punk audience don't like that.
Yeah.
But they have put a lot of effort into the songwriting.
Yes, and she was saying, I don't understand that. It's the only genre where that is a thing.
How dare you put some effort into making good songs for us? So go check it out at completemusicupdate.com/approved.
Attitude is Everything, a charity that campaigns for better access to live music for deaf and disabled music fans, has launched its new State of Access report this week.
Which it does biannually. That's every other year, isn't it? That's what biannual means.
Yeah.
I always have to second think that when they say.
Well, technically it means every 6 months, doesn't it?
Well, that's the thing.
But no one really uses it. No one knows how to use it. So it's every 2 years.
So this is their latest report. So this is an organisation that's been around for quite some time, doing lots of good work, trying to persuade and pressure the live industry, so both venue owners and festivals, to make their events more accessible. And sometimes that involves some decent investment. Other times, actually, it just involves thinking about things. And it was interesting that the core... There's various things in this report, and you can go and download it for free. But the thing that they were really pushing actually was something they were already pushing through a campaign they launched with the Association of Independent Festivals last year, although there were some stats to back up why this particular campaign is a top priority for them at the moment. And this is a campaign asking festival organisers and venues to do something that will really help deaf and disabled music fans, but requires actually relatively little effort on the part of the promoter.
Yeah, because they did some research and they found that 1/3 of all venue and festival websites have no information about accessibility on them.
So the point being that if you are a disabled or deaf music fan, obviously there are things that could be instituted at the event or at the festival at the venue that will help make the event more accessible. But before they even do that, they have to make a decision. Do I buy a ticket or do I not? And so the first place they're going to go in order to make that decision is the official website of the festival or the venue. Say, okay, how many steps are there? Is there lifts? You know, all of that sort of stuff. Is there seating? How much seating? All of that. And as you say, a third of venues and festivals aren't providing any information.
No, and if you look at just independent venues, that increases to 2/3.
So what they're saying is that a big chunk of music fans simply won't be buying tickets for these festivals and these venues because they're coming to the website, they're looking for the information they need. It's not very difficult to have a page clearly labelled that has that information, but a big chunk of festivals and venues have not yet done it.
Yeah, and before, you know, major venues get all excited and go, well, look, it's the independent venues laying us down, and if we're involved, only a third of venues don't have any of this information. Well, actually, they also found in this report that less than 1/5 of websites have what Attitude Is Everything would call good accessibility information.
Yeah, just because you've got a page.
You can't just have a page that says,
yeah, we've got some stairs.
We have, it's accessible. You need to be quite detailed in the information. You need to, you know, they brought up things like, are there 2 steps down to the floor or not? You know, you need to lay out exactly what is accessible and what isn't.
And I suppose, yes, if you do not have friends who are disabled or deaf music fans, and obviously there are lots of different disabilities that people will have, often you don't think about things which actually, when they're pointed out to you, are bleeding obvious. Of course people need this information, of course this needs to be on our page, but until they're pointed out of you, you probably wander around a venue and don't even realise, oh, hang on a second, that little thing there is an accessibility issue, and A, is there anything we can do to make it not an accessibility issue, but B, if we can't, for whatever reason, it's impossible to change the building or we can't afford it, at the very least, this is information we need to share.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just music, I mean, it's everywhere. Like, when you start pushing someone around in a wheelchair, which is something I do with certain regularity, you realise, like, how inaccessible almost everything is. But, you know, music venues, music's supposed to be a thing for everyone. And I think, you know, what Attitude Is Everything regularly point out is that venues don't make it that easy. Or just live music companies in general, ticketing is obviously a problem as well that I think we've talked about before. So, but this is something that seems very easy to fix. And I think that's why they're focusing on this here. Start small and let's build up from there.
There will always be resource issues. Those independent venues are often operating on the tightest profit margins. We've talked about those issues before. And, you know, you might say, well, it would only cost you £100 to do this. And for a lot of venues, it's like, we don't have £100. And even for big venues, which probably don't have that excuse, if they needed to, they could find the money. But some venues are massive, big old buildings where there are all sorts of issues, where, well, actually, it's a really big project to do that. Somebody's buildings are listed, etc., etc. Whereas simply sitting down and writing a decent bit of information and providing it in a really obvious way, not having it hidden between 90 different pages of info to find it, is a really simple thing. So as we say, although they provided the stats as to why this is an issue and why it's an issue that the live industry should try and overcome, they actually launched their Access Starts Online campaign at the Festival Congress last year. And part of that is, well, it's twofold. It is A, to encourage festivals and venues to think about this, and if they have not got this information available yet, make the information available, but also to help them. You say, good information is what we need, not just information. And so they have produced a load of resources to help venues work out what information they need to provide and sort of structure it in a user-friendly way.
Yes, so if you're a venue owner listening to this, sort that out.
Or a festival.
Just sort it out.
Go and get the information that Attitude Is Everything. And the Association of Independent Festivals have been very involved in this as well. So go and find the information that is now available online and sign up. And, be accessible, but also be informative about your accessibility.
Just quickly time to look through a handful of the things, important things, that we haven't had time to talk about in full this week. Metallica are the ambassadors for Record Store Day 2016.
You've always been...
I don't know what that means, but it sounds important.
Isn't it? So, yeah, Metallica will be bigging up Record Store Day, which is looming. April, is it, Record Store Day?
Yeah.
So, the day of record stores is coming and Metallica will be shouting about it.
And they're releasing a live album recorded at the Bataclan Theatre in 2003, and proceeds from the sale of that will go to charity.
So look out for that.
Peter Hutton from The Farm is going to lead the new Beatles Legacy Group in Liverpool.
Yes, the city council there has thought that there might be somewhere another few pounds that can be squeezed out of the Beatles in Liverpool, and this group is going to work out what
there's
that could
be. There's one kebab shop that doesn't have a cardboard cut out of the Beatles in it or something. I don't know. There's a lot of Beatles stuff in Liverpool already, but yes, this group is going to work out if there could be more.
So I look forward to seeing Peter's list of what else could be Beatles-themed in Liverpool.
The Magic Shop recording studio in New York is closing down, which is sad on a number of levels. But one, it's the studio where David Bowie recorded his final two albums.
And it's closing down despite Dave Grohl's best efforts to save it.
Yeah, Dave Grohl lent them money to pay off rent arrears and then tried to back a bid to buy
the building where it is.
Two floors of the building that it's in. But it seems that it's worth too much to the building owners in rent and a lot more than the studio is currently paying.
But the project will live on because he's going to carry on. The guy who runs it...
Yeah, he's increasingly doing archiving. So archiving, it's an analogue studio largely, but he's doing digital archiving of both the studio's tapes and just tapes in general. So that business is going to carry on. So there will be an element of the Magic Shop that will continue, just not as a recording studio as it currently is. Stands until next month.
Bieber news
is the sad discovery that he is not actually the Messiah,
despite all that fire. It's exactly the sort of thing a Messiah would have, all of that fire.
No, well, he said ahead of the Brits in an interview with The Mirror that it just really went into detail. Oh, his fans shouldn't worship me, they shouldn't place all their faith in me or their trust in me, I'll only let them down. And it's another example of Justin Bieber talking about himself, even when he's saying, I'm not this thing you should put faith in. He does talk in terms of like how it's possible he might be Jesus.
That sort of relates to an earlier interview he gave a few months back where he sort of compared himself to Jesus.
Yes.
Your obsession with Bieber possibly being the second coming of Christ. It would be amusing if it turned out he was the second coming of Christ. That would create some theological challenges for the Christian faith. But anyway, as of today, the news is Bieber is not Jesus. All that fire probably means he's actually the Antichrist, the devil.
Could do.
He didn't say anything about not being the devil in that article, did he? And
he did say, if you put all your faith in me, I'll disappoint you.
But
anyway, you can read all about that and all the stories we just mentioned there if you go to the show notes at completemusicupdate.com/podcast.
Now, there was a day this week in the CMU Daily.
Yes.
Last week was a really quiet news week. Nothing happened.
Nothing
at all. I don't know if that was half term. It was a holiday in America. Nobody announced anything. So nothing happened. And then one day this week, every single music company announced something. There was a flurry of announcements one day. But we one-linered them all. One of the reasons we one-linered them all, one reason was that although they were interesting, they weren't big stories. So that's what one-liners are for in the CMU Daily, the sort of news in brief slot. But the other reason was Andy Malt had used up three of our slots, proper full story slots in the CMU Daily, with Eurovision news.
And rightly so.
So there's been
stand by my decision.
Lots of Eurovision news this week, apparently. Tell me what the Eurovision news is.
Well, I suppose the big Eurovision news
from a UK
this week from a UK perspective is that the six songs that are being put forward as our potential entries for this year's Eurovision Song Contest were unveiled on Radio 2 this week. Now, the Eurovision You Decide show, where we decide which of those six songs is going forward, is being held on Friday. So there's every chance that by the time you're listening to this podcast, you already know who is going forward as our entry.
Or could know. It's on BBC 4.
It'll be in the news somewhere.
It'll probably be in Monday CMU Daily.
It will be.
Probably about
it will be.
Nine
break
different
it into,
stories
yeah.
on it.
We'll do it. Yeah, that'll be fine. So I don't feel like there's any reason to list all of the people's names here.
Except, I suppose, to say, because I don't know if we have talked about this on the podcast before, this is a return to having the sort of the national voting stage, because for the last few years, some mysterious people at Radio 2 decided what our song and who the performer should be, whereas they're going back to how they used to do it years ago, which is they pick a number of songs, the public decides, and then when we inevitably come last, it's the public's fault rather than the judging committee's fault.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, whereas in recent years, yeah, people we're not sure who they are have picked a song which is clearly bad, and then it's been sent out, and all of Europe has gone, well, that is a bad song. This year, they have picked six songs that are clearly not going to win. They're all a bit boring, roughly sound the same, and they've gone, right, choose one of those. And then when it doesn't win, the public get the blame.
Now, we do know of at least one song which was put forward to the BBC to be in this six that we choose from, that whoever these mysterious people are, let's call them, I don't know, Maurice and Derek.
Yes.
So amongst the songs that Maurice and Derek...
You have picked their actual names there.
Well, there you go. That's a coincidence. Amongst the songs that Maurice and Derek...
Julio is the other one.
...could have chosen from but didn't, was a track by Paul Hartnell off of Orbital, formerly,
yes,
and someone else...
Fable.
Fable.
Who's an up-and-coming musician from Brighton. CMU approved a while ago.
And so they did a track... sort of to the brief, but a little bit too experimental.
Yeah, a little bit.
They put it online, didn't they? So you can.
Yeah.
It
so
it
well,
yourself.
They as the official songs were unveiled, they also unveiled their song. The BBC had said that they were going to give a range of songs that are all a bit different for the public to choose from. And as I said, they went, oh, actually, no, let's make them all basically the same. And but so they tested the water, but to be fair, did go quite out on a limb there and do something that is a bit experimental, a bit weird, a bit dark. However, I think would have gone over quite well. And there has been a certain swell in the Eurovision fanship who feel that this song should have gone forward to the choice. But we'll never know. It might not have won, but it would have been different. And I think that's better, really, standing out. I mean, there's been stuff that's been weird and dark in Eurovision before, and it's done quite well.
So, a bad choice on Derek and Maurice and whoever you said.
Julio.
Julio's part.
From Radio 2.
So those are two separate Eurovision bits of news. The six that we can choose from, the one we can't choose from. So what was the final bit of Eurovision news?
Well, actually, there are a couple more.
There was only one more in the daily, I think.
There was one last week as well.
Oh, there was. We talked about it on the podcast last week, didn't we? That they're changing the voting system.
Did we?
I think we mentioned that on last week's podcast.
Didn't we?
So let's not talk about that. It's a shame you've even brought it up, because you're just adding some
let's group it all
section.
In here. They're changing the voting system. It's going to be longer now. Anyway, the other thing was the Ukrainian entry, talking of artists doing something a bit dark, perhaps, or certainly unexpected. The Ukrainian entry is a song called 1944 by a singer called Jamala. It was put through pretty much unanimously by both the judging panel and the public.
In Ukraine?
Yes. The only problem is... it may be a bit political, and that's against the rules.
So the lyrics are actually about a historic event,
yes,
from 1944.
Yes. So it's about the exile of the Crimean Tatar people by Joseph Stalin in 1944. Just an innocent historical event. How could it possibly relate to today?
Except, of course, relatively recent events in the Crimea, which may or may not be part of Ukraine, or if you ask, Moscow is very much part of Russia now. So possibly a little bit of politics thrown in there. Certainly not overtly in the lyrics.
No, although the singer has basically said, yeah, when I'm singing this, I'm thinking about members of my family and the wider Crimean Tatar people. None of them could come back. Most of the people who came back to the area came back in the 1990s and
now
are still effectively not properly recognised in the country. So they're effectively kind of squatting there. They don't have official status and now are in danger of being moved out again because of
various political manoeuvrings.
And
I suppose the point is the Eurovision rules are very clear. No politics.
Yes.
Because otherwise we here in the UK would almost certainly be putting forward that rewrite of Freelines that was doing the rounds this week, pro-withdrawing the UK from the European Union.
Yes, the anti-Europe version of Three Lions, sung by a duo made up of one woman.
Which is quite amusing if you want to go and check it out. But we wouldn't be allowed to put that forward because it would be political and there is no politics at the Eurovision Song Contest, according to the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes. So things have been refused on these grounds before. Georgia put out a track called We Don't Want to Put It In. a few years ago. That was rejected because Putin, it turned out, sounds a bit like Putin.
Yeah.
And Georgia had just been to war with Russia. There was also Ukraine a few years ago, about a decade ago, I think, actually, put forward a song that had been the anthem, or the unofficial anthem, for their revolution the year before. And so they did put forward the same song, but they had to change the lyrics so that they weren't about a revolution anymore.
So this song, the Eurovision organisers are yet to rule on this song.
Yeah, so the deadline for entries is the middle of next month sometime, at which point I'm fairly sure they'll say, no, you can't have this song. But you never know. It might still go forward, and then Russia would get angry again, which is a big part of the Eurovision Song Contest. So I'm all for it.
So there you go. A lot of Eurovision news. If you are listening to this as it goes out on Friday morning, you can tune in on BBC. But they've had to put it on BBC 4 because it used to be on BBC 3 and there is no BBC 3 TV version anymore. So all of the sort of the spin-off Eurovision stuff is going to be on BBC 4 this week. So you can watch that programme.
What BBC 4 needs some entertainment.
It's some Eurovision nonsense in amongst all the highbrow art. So you can go and watch that. Oh, I assume it's on the iPlayer. So but I'm assuming there'll be some more Eurovision news on the CMU podcast when the contest itself appears.
Will do, yes.
Look forward to it.
Bloody love Eurovision.
Unless we take some time off in May because of Canada and The Great Escape. These are things for us to sort out, not
Let's
on the podcast.
Not put admin on the podcast again. We decided not to do that anymore.
So you do the admin that we do at the end of every podcast.
Okay. How close to last do you think the UK will come in this year's Eurovision Song Contest? Why not let us know at CMU on Twitter. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and my guest this week, Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
As you carry on here, I thought you'd stopped.
I hadn't stopped. I'll never stop.
Confuse me that you'd stop. We're keeping that bit in where you go, I'll try to think of a better thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Not this bit now.
Obviously.
No, because this bit's a disaster. I thought that bit was colourful.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, Matt can decide where he cuts.
Matt's eating crisps. I'm not sure his mind's on the game.